I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. This is Fronteras, a show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. June is Pride Month. It honors the Manhattan Stonewall Riots of 1969, which marked a tipping point for the gay liberation movement in the U.S. Despite great strides made by the LGBTQ community in recent years, a culture of shame still exists surrounding the so-called gay lifestyle. And this culture of shame is preventing Latino, gay, and bisexual men from medication that could prevent them from contracting HIV. Philip Schnars is an assistant professor at the University of Texas at San Antonio in the College of Education and Human Development. He's also co-director of the South Texas Consortium for HIV and STI Research. Schnars conducted research on a UTSA study that showed Latinos are less likely to take the drug PrEP, which dramatically reduces the chances of HIV infection. Schnars, who's a member of the LGBTQ community, says acceptance of PrEP by the medical community and activists alike was an uphill climb, especially in Texas.
And what we were seeing in Texas at the time, when I first came to San Antonio and PrEP was coming out on the market, was there was a huge pushback, not just from the normal individuals who would push back against such a medication, you know, conservatives, but also the AIDS service organizations in the area were not convinced that there was enough science behind the medication to start using it. So along with some folks in Austin, we started kind of this grassroots movement called Austin PrEP Access Project, which is now splintered off into a few other groups. But this study really came out of the need to understand who had access to PrEP in Texas, what were the social norms around PrEP in Texas, and then what were some of the barriers to accessing PrEP. And so that was really the impetus for this project, was this social movement around gay men's sexual health that was happening in South and Central Texas, and our desire to make sure that we had good data to say, here's what needs to be done in order to make sure that we can get access to those who need it most.
So how do you disseminate that information about PrEP to people who really don't know much about preventing the spread of HIV, except maybe through the use of condoms?
I think 6 years later, we're doing a much better job, especially in San Antonio, that it's not just the absence of HIV and STIs or avoiding unintended pregnancies, but it's really this conceptual framework for understanding how do we communicate needs to sexual and relationship partners? How do we make sure that we are paying attention to consent? And, you know, wrapping PrEP into this sort of conceptual framework around sexual well-being, I think, has done a great service for expanding awareness of PrEP to individuals who are really unaware that it even exists, because it wraps it up into this other framework around well-being rather than here's this pill that you can take that somewhat medicalizes a very intimate behavior that occurs between two people, right? There's still a lot of work to be done. If we could get into schools, which I don't know if that will ever happen, but that would be fantastic. And there's been a lot of individuals who have stepped up as sort of activists around PrEP. There's groups on Facebook, there's groups across other social media platforms. And I think once you begin to tell individuals that, hey, there's this medication available that can prevent individuals from getting HIV, the first question always becomes, why aren't more people taking this? And, you know, as we'll get into, I think, in this conversation, there are a lot of barriers that prevent people from accessing this medication. And so it's really community members at this point who are combating the stigma around PrEP and combating, you know, these other access barriers, I think.
So you have conducted a study which shows that Latino men, compared with their white or African-American counterparts, Latino, gay, or bisexual men, they don't access PrEP at the levels that, again, white or African-American gay or bisexual men do. And what were the results of that study?
So what we were asking in this study was about intention. Were you intending to use PrEP in the next 30 days? Like, were you intending to go and get a prescription for PrEP? We asked people to list individuals who would approve or disapprove of their PrEP use in the next 30 days. And when we looked at the white guys compared to the African-American or to the Latino-Hispanic population, white men had listed, on average, more people, so more different types of people, suggesting that there was a bigger social network that would be okay with their PrEP use compared to African-American or Latino men. But what was most kind of stood out for me anyways was when we looked at this people listing my family would approve or disapprove. Like, this was shocking to me, was that both white and African-American men indicated that their families would approve of PrEP use. Not a single Latino man in this study indicated that their family would approve of use. So why? We don't know. And we can maybe theorize about why this is. There was also a lot of stigma around issues related to religion and church, right? When we looked at organizations, for example, or groups of people that would disapprove of PrEP use, we kept seeing over and over again in our data that it was Latino and African-American men who kept identifying my church, my congregation, religion. So, and that, I think, really speaks to something that's a different factor than what maybe white gay men experience in Texas and in this region. It's not to say that white gay men aren't also religious, but there's something to be said, I think, about the cultural experience of Latino and African-American men as it relates to religion and as it relates to family that's very different than when we consider white gay and bisexual men. And so we don't have all the answers to that from this study, but I think it's a good starting point for asking more questions about, okay, so what is different about family? What is different about religion in these contexts? And why wasn't family listed as somebody that would approve? And how can we leverage family in these communities to help us increase PrEP uptake? Or how can we work with churches in these communities to help us increase PrEP uptake?
Is there a way to get more Latinos involved in or made aware of PrEP? Because perhaps, you know, they have that stigma, first of all, the cultural stigma in many Hispanic and minority households that if you're gay, you're probably still likely to be kicked out of the house. What do you say to them to try to encourage them, this is going to save your life, and would your family prefer to have you contract HIV and die, or would they rather accept you for being gay and live a healthy life?
That is the question that we're asking. You can come be on my research team anytime you want to at this point. That's the question that we're asking. And we think about behavior so much as an individual thing. So for me, it's not just about talking to the individual, getting the individual to understand the importance of PrEP, but it's also talking to the family and getting them to understand the importance of PrEP and breaking down these walls or these barriers that are generated because of stigma, right? Basically, PrEP is tied to wanting to have lots of risky sexual encounters. So they've referred to them as, excuse my language, but PrEP whores, or it's slut-shaming around it, right? Which we see is not actually the case. What happens is that individuals who go on PrEP, the number of sexual encounters goes down, or they begin using condoms when they're on PrEP. So there's a lot more, the health behaviors, if you will, increase.
Once you've taken that first step.
Once you've taken that first step, right? But there's also this connection to PrEP as being a gay medication because it's tied to HIV, which we still, you know, 30 years later are saying, oh, it's a gay disease, which we know that it's not. When you look at it globally, it's actually more heterosexual people have HIV than non-heterosexual people. But I think in a place like San Antonio where there is still a lot of stigma around being gay, so I think that also adds further stigma and shame around taking PrEP, because if you look at Hispanic or Latino culture, really homosexuality, that's not the sin, right? It's what position were you in the sexual encounter, and then that's the sin. And so there's lots of cultural variables here that we have to address. You know, we are seeing an increase in HIV. We had Cluster 51. I don't know if you all are aware of what Cluster 51 is. It was a cluster of new HIV cases that occurred in San Antonio, primarily among young Latino men. It was one of the largest clusters in the United States. So there's these things that are happening that we can prevent. But we have to have harder discussions about not just HIV and PrEP, but also sex, and we have to have conversations about LGBTQ individuals, and we have to come to some agreement that there is room for all of these things here in San Antonio, that there's room for religion, that there's room for family, that there's room for gay people, that there's room for these sexual health conversations. And it's tying all those things together that's really going to reduce HIV, I think, in San Antonio.
Philip Schnars is an assistant professor at the University of Texas at San Antonio and the College of Education and Human Development. He's also co-director of the South Texas Consortium for HIV and STI Research. More of my interview with Schnars is available on TPR.org. Still to come, the cultural stigma of being Latino and gay is even further inflamed when one is Latino and transgender.
As a young child, I realized at a very early age, probably around 4 or 5, that I was a girl. I knew I was a girl. There was no doubt in my mind.
San Antonio's LGBTQ community celebrates their diversity with art and photography. Next on Fronteras. Stay with us. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. The LGBTQ community is embracing a few more letters. LGBTQI+, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer, questioning, intersex, and plus. The plus stands for the supporters of the LGBTQI community. It's a diverse community, and an exhibit in San Antonio is celebrating their individuality. 12 artists weave their identities, narratives, and history into the exhibit We Are. We're joined today by two of those artists, Jose Villalobos and Antonia Padilla, and Sebastian Guajardo, Special Projects Manager with the City of San Antonio's Department of Arts and Culture. Villalobos created an installation for the exhibit.
So the installation is composed of what I consider like traditional objects that I grew up seeing growing up in the border town of El Paso, Texas, and Ciudad Juarez, and also traveling into Mexico. What I have in the space is a saddle, a Western saddle, that is decorated or altercated with golden fringe on it. And also I have some cowboy boots that have been deconstructed in multi-layers. Also incorporates flowers, hummingbirds. There's also a traditional Western wear. I would always see like my uncles and cousins, like the men, particularly the men in the family, wear these types of clothing. And those specific articles of clothing are untouched. And it's kind of like serves as a reminder of the tradition that's carried on. It's still like family expectations or cultural expectations.
So what were you trying to communicate with the deconstruction of the cowboy boots and with the saddle and with, you know, the cowboy hat and the pants? What is it that you're trying to communicate to the person who goes and sees that?
My body of work deals with the restraints of being a gay person. What I've tried to communicate with my work is these ideas of repression and oppression of being Latino and being gay, and also being having this expectation of what a man should be like in the Mexican-American, a lot of Mexican background on my end, so I speak for myself, is all these expectations that my family had or still has of me. And the deconstruction of the boots, it's kind of deconstructing masculinity. So I deconstruct these objects that are considered to symbolize something that is masculine. And then in turn, I make them, I kind of feminize them is what I do. And I hate, you know, it's not that I hate to use that word, but it's more of making it into something extremely flamboyant. By deconstructing these things, like the boots, it serves as a reminder of kind of pushing down on who I truly am as a person. There's a hummingbird at the very end layer of the boot, and it's beneath these a bed of flowers that I have placed. And it's kind of this idea of burying your freedom. So that's traditionally also the symbolicism behind the hummingbird. It resembles freedom. Behind the installation on the wall, there's a bunch of yellow flowers. And those yellow flowers are kind of an indicator of cowardice. But also within that, each flower kind of represents that courage and that built-up courage to be able to come out at a later time in my life, which I came out in my early 20s, when I was away from home.
And so, Antonio Padilla, it's one thing to be Hispanic and gay, and now it's another thing to be Hispanic and transgender.
Absolutely.
So tell us a little bit about what you had to overcome.
Expectations that Jose spoke of. Expectations are a great burden placed upon us by everyone, society in general. And you can find that around the world, and it's not limited to the Hispanic culture. The expectations of conforming are such that it does indeed cause people to take their lives because they feel that they'll never be able to meet up to someone else's standards. And as a young child, I realized at a very early age, probably around 4 or 5, that I was a girl. I knew I was a girl. There was no doubt in my mind. And I could not understand why my parents forced me to wear pants, shirts. Why didn't I have pretty little skirts? Where were my black patent leather T-straps? Where were my little ruffly socks? Where was my button bow blouse? I had none of that, and I couldn't understand any of it. It was quite confusing.
Well, tell us about when you got your first camera, because this is going to lead up to the exhibit that we're talking about right now.
Sure. And for Christmas, I asked my parents for a Barbie doll, and they basically ran away screaming, pulling their hair out. And my dad was a medical illustrator at Brooks Air Force Base, and he had a lot of cameras, and I used to play with him as a child. And the little light bulb went off in my parents' head, hey, let's get our son a camera, and that'll make him forget about the Barbie doll. Well, I didn't forget about the Barbie doll, and by the way, I have several Barbies now, which I'm very proud of. One of them is still in the box. I got this camera for Christmas. It was a Polaroid, and I loved it. I immediately took to it. It was a means of expression, and that started me down a path speaking a visual language, which I use to communicate to people. I'm a former newspaper photographer, and I did that for 15 years. I worked at magazines as well. So
let us know about this particular piece that you have at this exhibit. We are at the Culture Commons Gallery. If you're far away, it has to draw you in because it's a large framed piece, but with a lot of little individual panels.
Right.
You don't know what they are up until
right.
you get up to them. And they're all Polaroid type pictures.
Yes, they're all Polaroids.
And
exactly.
And after looking at a few, you realize, wait a minute, this is the same person.
It is.
So tell us about how you put that together. Because
okay.
there's a little bio right next to it that says these pictures never really were meant to be shared with anybody.
That's correct. During the time I did this, and this spans about 30 years of my life, because of my love for the Polaroid, I had a Polaroid Spectra, which fortunately had a tripod mount in it, and I would use that to do pictures. I'm such a ham bone. I love to model. And what I would do is I would set up a camera and do these little vignettes, you know, hit the self-timer. And so I did that from 1985 to about 2015 when the camera broke. And I couldn't get another one.
I have to say, they're very boudoir-y. I mean,
and here's the reason for that. Because I was not out in Brownsville, Texas, where I was a news photographer, I presented as a quote-unquote man, and that is how everyone knew me. But at home, I would literally slip into something comfortable, which for me was lingerie. And I ended up buying a lot of lingerie because that was the one item that I could wear at home and not be like in a Sunday dress sitting there on the couch. So I would set up these little vignettes, have a glass of wine, take some pictures. I just basically squirreled all these things away. A couple of years ago, I was moving stuff around, and I came across about 100 of them. And, you know, I was like, wow, yeah, look at this. All these pictures when I was a lot younger and a lot slimmer than I am now. somehow Sarah and I were talking, and she was like, oh my gosh, we got to do something with this, and which led to the display of 21 Polaroid pictures in little wooden frames. So you're right, Norma. When you look at it from a distance, it kind of looks like one matrix of work, but as you get closer to it, you see that they're individual pictures.
Yeah, I think this exhibit and the artist, it's meant to celebrate. It's a celebration that we're alive and we've survived.
That was Sebastian Guajardo, Special Projects Manager with the City of San Antonio's Department of Arts and Culture. We also spoke with artists Antonia Padilla and Jose Villalobos. They are two of the 12 artists whose work is featured in the exhibit We Are, on display in San Antonio's Culture Commons Gallery through July 13th. For more of my interview with the artists, visit tpr.org. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Norma Martinez produced the broadcast. Our executive producers are Steve Short and Fernando Ortiz. Our digital editor is Vince Kong. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. And happy Pride.